You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As we've seen many times throughout the world in recent years, natural disasters have the power to completely devastate a region, leading to tremendous loss of life, huge economic losses as well, especially in poorer countries. When that happens, developed countries like the U.S. often step in and offer aid. But according to our next guest, disaster aid from wealthier countries doesn't always line up with the affected country's actual needs. The worst disasters don't always get the most aid, and maybe a new approach, he says, is needed. Joining us now is Tim Kovach. He is an analyst and blogger who researches and writes about climate change, disaster risk reduction, and environmental peace building. He recently wrote a piece on disaster relief for Vox. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So, first of all, give us a sense of the scope when we look at the human and the economic impact of these disasters. What kind of numbers are we looking at?
Yeah, people tend to focus a lot on conflict and violence, but in reality, the effects of disasters globally are truly astounding. From 1980 to 2000, disasters killed approximately 1.5 million people. And directly affected by that, we mean killed, injured, displaced, more than 2.3 billion worldwide. And recently, the UN's agency who works on disasters noted that there has been more than 48 million life years lost in the past 20 years or so. And by that, they mean dying prematurely based on the expected life expectancy for a person in a given country. And the economic costs from these disasters are truly astonishing. Currently, they cost roughly $250 to $300 billion per year, and that number is expected to grow to over $315 billion within the next few years. And if you look at especially the total dollar values are going to be greater in countries like the U.S. and Japan and the U.K. because we have a much larger economy. But if you look at the per GDP effects of disasters in poorer countries, they can be truly amazing. Large disasters in least developed countries can reduce GDP from anywhere to 5 to 15% in any given year.
Now, you write that there's often a mismatch. The disaster relief efforts that may have the most money going into them may not go to the places that have taken the worst damage, that have had the most impact on human life.
That's right. For the most part, the number of deaths and the amount of money provided generally line up, but deaths aren't necessarily the most accurate number for need in the aftermath of a disaster. Like I mentioned, the number of affected people is probably a better measure to go off of, because you're looking people who need to have their homes replaced, who need to have food provided for them in the meantime. A lot of people may have lost their livelihood. Say you're a herder in a rural village and an earthquake or a flood comes and kills your livestock. That may completely undermine your ability to provide food and income for yourself. And so when you look at take three recent very large disasters, for example, the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami, the 2010 earthquake that hit Haiti, and then the 2010 floods that hit Pakistan. And you'll see that Pakistan in the weeks after the disaster got just $16 per person, despite the fact that the floods affected more people than the Haitian earthquake and the tsunami combined. The per person totals for the Pakistan earthquake in 2005 were $388, and for the Indian Ocean tsunami were almost $1,250 per person.
So let's get into why some disasters get more attention than others. First of all, I guess earthquakes, tsunamis, they're sudden, they're flashy in some ways. We could see the immediate urgency. Something like a slower burn, like a flood or a famine, doesn't seem to generate the same response, you write.
That's right. And I think a lot of that is what you mentioned. It has to do with the fact that earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, things of that nature are those rapid onset kind of shock value events. But the one study that I was looking at that came out in 2007 actually said that in order for a famine like the one that we saw occur in the Horn of Africa in 2011 to get the same level of coverage in an American nightly newscast, you would need to have as a single victim of an earthquake, you need to have 38,920 people die. And obviously, it can be difficult for a newscast to cover these types of slow moving disasters because the events are coming on over a course of several days or weeks. But at the same time, it's important to not allow the media, the daily demands of the media to affect the actual outcomes of disaster relief.
Talking to Tim Kovach about disaster relief, he says we need to make some changes in the way we provide relief for disasters around the world. Let's stay with the media, though, because you write that media coverage can drive the response from personal, individual donors, from government donors, and that media response depends on the disaster and what else is in the news that day.
That's right. So, like, this study that I was looking at took data from 1968 to 2002 from an archive that Vanderbilt keeps of the U.S. nightly newscasts from the major broadcast networks. And what they found is that for every two minutes that the network spent on their top three stories, the likelihood that they'll actually end up covering any given disaster falls by 4%. And in addition, if the disaster occurs at the same time as the Olympics or the World Series, the likelihood of coverage is going to fall by 5 to 6%. And that can have a significant impact on the actual amount of, and the likelihood of aid being given and the amount of aid being given. And so what they did is they also looked at the amount of aid provided by the U.S. Agency for International Development's Office for Foreign Disaster Assistance, I'm sorry. And that's the primary arm of the U.S. government for providing aid in the wake of disasters. And they found that if the nightly news broadcast covered a disaster, it would increase the likelihood that a disaster would get covered by 16%. But more than that, if it didn't cover the disaster would need to have six times more fatalities than one that occurred that did get coverage.
So far we've been looking at response after a disaster. You say that needs to change and it needs to be covered differently, addressed differently. But also you say we should rethink things and focus on disaster impact prevention, that a lot of what we think are natural disasters, acts of God, call them what you will, our behavior beforehand can affect the outcome a lot.
That's right. What I would consider to be a general misconception that disasters are, as you mentioned, acts of God. In reality, the literature says that a disaster is a combination of three things. It's a natural hazard, like a fault line or a tropical storm. It's our exposure to that disaster. So if we have, say, our house is built in a floodplain or lost along a coast or on top of a fault line, and then our vulnerability to that disaster. So say a homeless person who it doesn't have the ability to get shelter for the night is a lot more vulnerable to a tropical storm than a person who is able to be in a home that maybe have buried power lines or something like that, so they wouldn't even lose power. And so accordingly, it's really important to try to tackle those drivers of disaster risk before the disaster ever occurs. And the main way that we would go about this is a thing called disaster risk reduction. And there's a number of things that you can do to invest in disaster risk reduction. One example that's very popular is early warning systems. So in the U.S., if a tornado is going to hit like it does in the Midwest frequently, I live in Cleveland, so I'm not immune to that. You'll likely get a report. You'll likely get a notification from the National Weather Service on your smartphone, on your radio, on your television. But the same thing won't necessarily happen in a poor developing country. If you live in a rural area in Bangladesh and there's a tropical cyclone coming, you may not necessarily get the same level of reporting. And so it's important to invest in those types of early warning systems to give people the critical head start that they need to protect themselves and their property. Other examples are, say, investing in natural capital. So the one thing that I spoke about in the article was replanting mangrove forests. And these are a particular type of coastal wetland that are found in a lot of areas, but the vast majority of them have been cut down for various reasons since the mid part of the 20th century. But these mangroves do an outstanding job of buffering the impacts of storm surges and tsunamis. Their roots stick out in all different directions. They can essentially stop waves and really reduce the impact by up to 90%. So if we were to restore these mangrove forests, we could not only provide opportunities for people to harvest, say, honey and building materials, but also protect them from disasters themselves.
So, Tim, in the aftermath of a major disaster, it's easy in some cases to persuade governments and individuals to donate. We see the immediate urgent need. How do you sell this sort of long-term thinking, a multi-year project to replant mangrove swamps or to build warning systems in a developing country?
Sure, and this is a difficult issue because a lot of people see disaster risk reduction as kind of separate from the development process. But the real important issue is to try to make the connections between existing development projects and disaster risk reduction, and also now to link it to climate change adaptation and mitigation. And so, there was a conference last month. It was the Third World Conference on Disaster Risk Reduction held in Sendai, Japan, which is actually kind of the epicenter of the 2011 earthquake and tsunami that hit Japan. And there were a lot of things that came out of that, but they actually set some concrete goals. And one thing was that Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, said that sustainability begins in Sendai. And what he meant by that was that later this year, coming up in September in New York, the UN is going to meet to develop a concrete list of what they're called sustainable development goals. And they're going to replace the Millennium Development Goals that were implemented in 2000 to try to reduce global poverty and reduce, improve access to water and sanitation and things of that nature. So sustainable development really needs to incorporate disaster risk reduction.
We'll leave it there. Tim, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Tim Kovach. He's an analyst and blogger. He researches and writes about disaster risk reduction. This is Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.